We do have Jadub trapped in this room. It is locked. He cannot escape.
We used to have lunch at some time. That's it.
Yeah, that's true.
Good, we can do that.
What if we were eating while we did it? We were like, so God.
It just becomes a ASMR.
Yeah, it'll be terrible.
It's like, people get really close to a mic and they're like, hello.
They like whisper.
And some people will listen to ones that they eat food.
Yeah, like just hear everything. Yeah. It's just like, ah, gosh. I'm trying to have people that close in my ear all the time.
Welcome to TikTok Theology, a podcast that tackles the major trending topics on social media that concern the Christian faith. I'm Megan.
And I'm Steven. We know you can't form a theology in 3 minutes or less, but those videos can identify current issues. TikTok will give us the prompt, and then we'll do a deep dive. Thanks for joining us in this exploration.
Hi, friends, and welcome back. This week, we have another just lighthearted conversation surrounding some of the easiest topics in theology. That is a lie. Mm. So don't worry. Today, we're talking about the reconciling the violence of God in the Old Testament, primarily. But I feel like this one is and it seems kind of niche in the way that we're talking about it as a theological discussion. But I've seen a lot in conversations around Christianity and stuff on social media, especially as we've been in a kind of an interesting climate in the world where we have like the Israel-Palestine conflict, we have the Ukraine-Russian conflict, and we have obviously a lot of Christians, a lot of opinions on these two things. That's not what we're discussing today, but it has brought up a lot of conversations on social media about this concept of, is God like violent? Like, what's his view? Like, is this view on war? And like, the Old Testament God seems to have a very different view on, you know, wars and violence than maybe the New Testament portrayal of God does. Right. And, you know, all of those different conversations that we're having and really hashing through at this space in social media and Christendom as a whole. And so we're going to tackle that topic today.
Yeah.
But we're not just alone.
Nope.
We have a very special guest today.
Yes, we do. I think it is one of the hardest, if not, it might be the hardest topic of biblical studies, like the hardest kind of like single topic. I mean, there's been so many theologies that just kind of have gone awry trying to even solve this problem. Like, I mean, that's how we got the demiurge and two different gods and stuff like that, like in the past. And like, just like, oh, the Old Testament God must be different than the New Testament because Jesus' witness is so different. And so and it's a question that inevitably students always ask.
Yes.
And even in church, and people will like just church members will ask, you know, different people, any Bible study, anything that always comes up. And a lot of times the answers are not good. And it's even the case where like the answers for this aren't entirely satisfactory even still, even when you've studied and learned a lot. So we thought no better guy to ask than one of our favorite guys on the whole planet. Dr. Jim W. Adams.
Woo!
All right. Thank you.
Right now, everybody in their car is cheering.
Everyone in the Hebrews are cheering.
They're all cheering.
The Old Testament Theo class is cheering.
Boo. Boo.
Hebrews is what we call the dudes that are in the Bible, biblical studies major. All the dudes are the Hebrews. J-Dub has a fan club of Hebrews.
He does.
He has a fan club. Yeah, but like, I'm part of the J-Dub fan.
Me
fan
too.
Club, you know what I mean? He has a much broader fan club than that.
Oh, you guys are too nice.
Me and Megan were like, you know what? People need to hear J-Dub. And so instantly I was like, we need to have him as a guest. And I wanted you to be a guest last season. And then you were like, no, I need at least 4 years to actually think about this topic in order to, before we talk about it. So we gave you until season two, and now he's here starting out our first guest of season two, which is super excited about it. So we've been kind of dancing around it. He is a longtime professor at Life Pacific University. Mm-hmm. He's an Old Testament scholar, did his PhD at Fuller. He's written a lot about all sorts of stuff of Old Testament studies, but particularly has been focusing on speech act theory and commands in the Old Testament. And he's just a very wise, awesome dude. He's been here, it's over 20 years, right? 25 or something?
This is 27, heading
27,
in 28.
Man.
Yeah, crazy.
He's worked here longer than Megan's been alive.
It's true.
Ouch.
And so,
Jade, didn't you teach my mom?
Yes.
Oh man, generations
to crazy
lords.
Yeah, but she was my first class. So
it's not that crazy.
No.
Okay, and then you taught Kelsey. So yeah, you've got. So he's been harassed by a generation of me.
Mm-hmm.
Just every single one of my family.
And
just
and harassed, I wouldn't put it that way.
No, the lords are good students. They're good to have as students.
Joy.
So, for sure.
Joy to have.
Also, one little tiny fact is he's also an avid skater.
That's true.
And surfer.
Mm-hmm.
And I have wanted to do this for a long time, but one of the things that we do in our programs, we do music videos, and I just had J-Dub as a special cameo guest skateboarding and in our music video. So we're going to link that in the show notes so that way you can see J-Dub in his element. So in the bridge of the song Weep No More, check it out. You're going to see J-Dub.
That was fun.
Yeah, yeah. It was so good.
See, when he does things with us, it's fun. He's yeah. a good time. Yeah, we just got to get him to do it.
Okay, so here we go. Jim, the first question that I hear all the time from students is why does the character of God seem so different in the Old Testament than in the New Testament? And like I was just alluding to, I mean, this is where we even like some people have tried to solve that problem by creating a demiurge and saying that God is different in there, you know, or different gods there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is kind of the big question. How should we as a church understand these differences and how should they shape our theology?
Yeah, so I think that first and foremost, Jesus himself in the Gospels, obviously, and the Gospel writers, as well as the New Testament writers, identify Jesus as the God of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So the God of Israel is one deity, but by the time we get to the New Testament, he obviously is then revealed as three. We get hints at it in the Old Testament.
Yeah.
So Jesus is this same God. So what Marcion did in the second century in creating really the first canon in seeing this radical difference between Jesus's teachings and the God of the Old Testament, that this debate, this question has been since Jesus's teachings almost, that these are two different gods. But I think we certainly see Jesus commanding us in Matthew, in Luke, love your enemies. And we seem to see God in the Old Testament violently attacking enemies. But if we look carefully at Jesus' words too, he says himself also that I don't come to bring peace but a sword. He talks about eternal damnation. He is one who makes a whip in John and casts out the sellers in the temple. So there's a lot of corroboration between what we see in the Old Testament and what we see in the New Testament with Yahweh and Jesus being part of that deity, if you will, the second person of the Godhead. So I think if we look carefully, there's a lot more corroboration between how Jesus is depicted and how Yahweh is depicted in the Old Testament. That being said, we don't see Jesus developing the church or instructing the church to be an army that's going to go out and physically conquer other lands. That's a difference that we see where Israel is actually a nation with boundary markers, with a land that Yahweh has given Israel, where the people of God are located on that land, whereas now within Christianity, obviously Christians are global.
Yeah.
So let's say, you know, if we were to like build an army of a country and go attack another country, you're attacking Christians.
Yeah.
Right. And that's the problem with war is I think some wars are legitimate if you're protecting yourself. But if we're in any case, if the U.S., for example, goes and attacks another nation, we are inevitably going to kill Christians.
Yeah.
That's the problem with war in general. But I think we're seeing a lot more cooperation between what we see with Jesus and Yahweh than there are differences.
Yeah. Just a little sidebar about, you know, wars and just, I think, you problematizing that idea, I think, is really important because one of the issues of Israel becoming a state again is that they specifically became a secular state,
mm-hmm.
that they became a state that's intentionally not the same nation state that was in the mm-hmm. Old Testament, mm-hmm. You know, when they, in the 1900s, when they became a state again. And I think that is part of the, when Christians are saying like, we need to be pro-Israel and stuff like that, which I'm not saying that we shouldn't, you know what I mean? Like, I think Israel is certainly justified to respond to, you know, what Hamas did. Like, there's no question about that. Mm-hmm. But I think sometimes people see that as like, they're part of a holy war and you need to be backing Israel because God's on Israel's side. When even that, like, it's supposed to be a secular state. So it's like, they have themselves made a distinction between that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, and I think it's important in the Old Testament that Israel is not, because Israel is God's people, they're not exempt from God's punishment.
Yeah, his judgment.
And so to be blindly pro-Israel and, God's for them no matter how they act.
Right.
Is, well, ridiculous, but also doesn't correspond with the Old Testament.
Right. No, that's a good point.
Yeah.
I mean, you could even say that God puts Israel up on extra scrutiny, you know, because they are his people.
Absolutely. So they're under more pressure, if you will,
yeah.
of being God's people. And so the nations typically, when he has the prophets speak against the nations and there's the threat of violence, let's say, with the other nations, there it's more generalized. Oftentimes it's based on their pride, whereas mm-hmm. Judah and Israel, they're in trouble because they're not following the law. They knew better.
Right.
Where the nations aren't in that category. Even you don't see nations being condemned for their idolatry mm-hmm. very much.
No.
Israel's condemned for their idolatry.
Yeah, because they're in covenant with God.
Right, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, that's good. Also, I think when you were answering the question, another idea I had or thought I had coming up is, do you think we understand the rhetoric of God's violence mm-hmm. better by understanding Jesus and how he used violence rhetorically? For instance, like when he's going with the whip, this is a prophetic demonstration that salvation is going to come through Christ and that the system of atonement that the Israelites used forever was outdated, outmoded, and now it is coming through Christ. And so it was a symbolic gesture. Mm. And so he used that in rhetoric as opposed to like a goal to hurt people. Or, mm. you know, and even when you said, you know, I didn't come to make peace, I came to make war, to set mm-hmm. daughters against mothers, sons against fathers and stuff like that. He's using a rhetorical device there too, mm-hmm. I think, to talk about ultimate allegiance to God mm-hmm. over even familial things. Even that, you know, when he's talking about, if you're going to follow me, hate your mother and your father.
True. Yeah.
And I think that's kind of like, it's breaking this glass ceiling of a metaphor. Like, our love for God needs to be far beyond even, you know, our greatest loving relationships on earth and in the total devotion. I think does that, because we can, I think, easily understand the way, or not easily, I think it's still difficult for people, but like, it's still like not necessarily easier than in the Old Testament, we can understand the way Jesus is using his words rhetorically.
Yes.
Does that help us to understand how the Old Testament, how God is using, you know, calls for violence rhetorically there?
I think there's some truth there, but I think we can also see that rhetorical device occurring in the Old Testament itself. Mm-hmm. So in other words, one of the more troubling words in the Hebrew Bible in relationship to war is the word harem, which is oftentimes translated as utterly destroy. Mm. And it's coupled with oftentimes with war, and it involves people groups. So like when the conquest, when Joshua and Israel's going into the land, they're to utterly destroy Jericho, utterly destroy other people groups, and it seems pretty, you know, gnarly. I mean,
yeah, for sure.
And everybody's obliterated. But if we look at how the ancient Near East, so there's a guy named Younger who did this study on ancient conquest accounts, and he was looking at ancient Near Eastern stuff and how they're using hyperbolic language.
Yeah. Totally.
And that then is what we're seeing as well in the Old Testament. So when that word is used, so there's two problems with the word. One is it probably is better to understand that word as ban or even remove, not utterly destroy.
Mm. Okay.
And it's more about removing Israel from religious paraphernalia as well as the influence of the Canaanites.
Yeah.
Rather than going in slaughter.
Mm.
Yeah.
Now, it can involve destroying, but destroying religious paraphernalia where right. it cannot be used. This is the problem of Achan in the early parts of Joshua. He steals that paraphernalia, and now violence is outbroken on him due to that sin. And what's fascinating is that in Joshua, that's the only instance where you have God being angry and violent in Joshua is with his own people.
Wow.
So what we're seeing back to your question is that this hyperbolic language Israel would have understood.
Yeah.
So you have, for instance, in what this is called the Merim Ptah Stela, which is the Egyptian pharaoh talking about how he wiped out Israel, but they weren't wiped out.
Right.
Same with the Mesha inscription. King Moab says he actually haremed Israel, destroyed Israel, but they weren't destroyed. It's just a way of talking about conquering, not completely slaughtering everybody. So I think Jesus is actually in that similar mode, if you will.
Uh-huh, for sure.
Than what we see. So like another example is when a person commits adultery, you're to stone them to death. Mm-hmm. But nobody's ever stoned to death in the Old Testament.
Hmm.
So that's either, well, they didn't obey anyway, so they're not going to obey that. But if you look at like with John 8, when Jesus is confronted with the adulterous woman, and he says, the person without sin cast the first stone.
Yeah.
We always think in terms of, well, they were all convicted of sin, which is quite possible and probably a reality.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe also because they're testing Jesus, he got it right. We don't do this typically.
Yeah.
And it would have been hypocritical for us to actually stone her.
That's good.
So I think that what we see this kind of gnarly language, but it's not acted out. So Rahab is not, she's under this harem, but she survives. She's not put to death. So I think we need to, and this is the thing about the Bible is we need to, if you just kind of cursory read Joshua, we either spiritualize it or it's crazy. You know, you think, oh, utterly destroy or whatever. Yeah. But if we look carefully at the text and go, okay,
so important.
There's more going on here, this mass slaughtering.
I tell my students, I literally just told them this morning, I was like, the Bible writers didn't have a problem with the meaning of this text. We do. you know, there's a big difference there.
Yeah.
We've lost the context of it. So we kind of have to understand it. But the people who are reading it then would have known.
And what's really fascinating along those lines is that the New Testament writers never condemn the conquest of Canaan.
Right.
Yeah.
Jesus doesn't. Stephen doesn't in his speech. Paul doesn't. The Hebrew writer to the Hebrews, he lauds their faith.
Yeah.
Right.
So we're the ones who are appalled by it, but maybe we need to look more carefully about what's going on there in Joshua than this, what is typically thought of as a genocide, an ethnic cleansing.
Yeah.
We need to think carefully about what's happening in that.
Maybe it's hyperbolic and it seems to be always wrapped around about holiness, you know, making sure that there's no other idols or anything being brought in and that's wiped away is what you're
absolutely
saying,
and then really there's two reasons for the conquest. One, it is the culmination of Israel's birth as a nation. God promised them that land.
Mm.
Number two, removing this influence of theological influence and religious practice influence, as well as how they do society, where it would be more hierarchical, king, top down kind of thing.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Israel on that land needs to be unique. Because Yahweh is unique. They need to exemplify what it means to be a worshiper and follower of Yahweh.
Yeah.
That means removing everyone from that. So yeah, that's a tough sell, if you will, because removing people from their land.
Mm-hmm.
But what we don't see in Joshua is that Israel's going in and punishing the Canaanites.
Mm.
There isn't, like I said earlier, God isn't angry with the Canaanites, and so he's got to punish them or remove them. It is more has to do with Israel being a unique people on their unique land, worshiping this one God. And we know that still didn't work.
Yeah.
But that was the goal.
I just want to show the parallel even of, you know, having them take the land and occupying the land that was promised. That is the issue always in the Middle East. That's like literally still what's going on.
Yeah.
Was the Israelites reoccupying.
Yeah.
areas, Gaza, and after generations of not being there.
Yeah.
And then bringing back the Hebrew language. Like, all this stuff happened. I think that people don't fully understand that Jews were around always, but persecuted in Europe a lot and, mm-hmm. and like in different areas and in the US, but there was a diaspora. And so there was a move to move back, the Zionist move to move back to the land and then occupy that. And that might've displaced some of the Palestinians that were there. But then like, who has the claim of the land? Mm-hmm. And so, but then if you, you know, you'll hear people are hearkening all the way back to like, hey, Joshua moved in and he shouldn't have done that in the first place. Mm-hmm. But then that was the land promised to Abraham. Like, so man, this has been going on
yeah.
literally forever.
Yeah.
Nothing new under the sun, huh?
No. And that's what I think what's so complicated about, well, just life in general, but war especially, is that when you have Israel occupying the land again, Palestinian Christians were displaced.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's heartbreaking.
It's crazy. You know, yeah.
So there's no simple answer to any of this.
The NATO has been trying to push a two-state mm-hmm. solution, and neither of them seem too happy with that kind of a solution. So there we are. This is our dilemma.
So I think even as we've kind of touched on a lot of stuff and these differences or perceived differences, is what would you your take just simply be if someone asked you, like, does God condone violence? Mm-hmm. And so is that, because I feel like some people want that to be a blanket statement, like a yes right. or a no. Mm-hmm. And I feel yeah. like as everything is, there's a gray area. Very mm-hmm. few things, especially certain elements of theological realities in scripture, are very rarely like mm-hmm. black and white. And this is how it's always is in every single situation. Yeah. And this is how it's not in every single situation. So how would you respond if someone were to ask, because I mean, Gen Z especially, like, we are not war people. Like, we are anti-violence people. Like, we are like...
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of this generation that's like, I'd rather do literally anything than ever go to war or have violence or something like that. So how would you respond if someone, like a student, was like, hey, J-Dub, like, does God condone violence?
Well, and for me, so I'm on board with Gen Z. I'm not, you know, I think that if somebody is convicted of murder, let's say, and I don't think anything in the Bible would argue against the death penalty, but I'm not the one who's going to pull that trigger.
Right.
Or yeah. I don't want to kill anybody.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I say to my students often, especially when I teach ethics, is there's a difference between morally good and morally justified. Mm-hmm. There might be situations where we find ourselves morally justified to defend our home or whatever, mm-hmm. but that doesn't even make that action good.
Right.
It's just justified.
Right.
You're just not wrong in the situation.
Right.
Well, I think that speaks to a lot of even like, the things of like, sometimes we can see how God acts in scripture and mm-hmm. we're like, that is just, but mm-hmm. to me, that's horrifying or like right. that doesn't yes. feel good. So yes. I feel like that plays a piece too, where it's like God's justice is also so different from what maybe we would articulate as just.
Yeah.
And so how would you then like speak to that?
So I think, first of all, I think what's very important is that the Bible has often been times used as kind of a strategy for how to execute war and justify war.
Yeah, Bible is not the book of war.
Yeah, it's, so I think there's been a lot of, especially contemporary scholars, trying to argue away the conquest. It either didn't happen.
Yeah.
Or like Gregory Boyd has this book, The Crucifixion of the Warrior God, and he argues that Israel misinterpreted what God said.
Yeah.
He wanted him... the Canaanites to be delivered, they heard, kill them, right? So that, but one of the dominant metaphors in the Old Testament, if not the, yeah. is God's a warrior God.
Right.
So he's engages in violence. He does meet violence with violence. The flood, a lot of times he's engaged in violence, but this is very important. He's not a capricious God, meaning he doesn't do things willy-nilly or for no rhyme or reason.
Yeah.
They're justified reactions, but they're oftentimes coupled with mercy at the same time.
Yeah.
But I think too, importantly, so going back to the conquest of the land of Canaan was a once for all time event. It yeah. wasn't now, okay, now go conquer Babylon. Now go conquer Egypt. Mm. Now go conquer these other nations to where you take over the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
It wasn't that. It was the land, that's it.
Yeah.
Never to be repeated again. When Israel engages in warfare. Like John Golden Gay identifies five different ways of warfare in the Old Testament. And there's probably more than that. But is one of the main reasons for identifying that is there's diversity in war. There isn't one way to do war. There isn't a strategy plan for how to do war or justify war. Mm-hmm. So I think that what we're seeing in the Old Testament, again, is God engages in violence, but it is really to maintain order in his creation, setting aside the conquest. So God's MO isn't violence, isn't, and this is very important as well. When God talks about his character, so one of the sole instances of God's description, self-description, is in Exodus 34, 6 and 7, coming off of the golden calf episode. He doesn't say, I'm compassionate, merciful, loyal, truthful, wrathful. Wrath and anger are not part of God's character.
Yeah.
Right.
They're not an attribute. He does get angry, and his anger is used typically as a means, especially with Israel, as a reaction to violation of the covenant, but also as uses anger in a disciplinary way to bring Israel back, to bring Israel to repentance.
Yeah.
So because God isn't an angry, wrathful God, that should then impact us about, is God pro-violence? No, he's pro-peace.
Yeah.
The irony is how do you establish peace?
Mm.
War.
Yeah.
Right? You have to conquer. So Solomon, for example, is a man of peace. How come he's a man of peace? David was a warrior.
Yeah.
He conquered, right? So there's some irony going on there as well. But in the end, as Christians, what we're seeing is that with the cross, Jesus now is embracing violence. Mm-hmm. And what's fascinating, I was just read this the other night by a scholar named Moberly. He was saying that the only person that's impacted by the violence on the cross is God himself.
Mm.
Nobody else is impacted by that violence.
Yeah. And we're saved from it.
Yeah. And so what we see in the Old Testament, Deuteronomy, and we see this in, I just read it this morning in Hebrews, we also see it with Paul, where God says, vengeance is mine.
Mm-hmm.
We leave retaliation, we leave injustices done to us in the hands of God rather than going out and violently attacking. So again, what do the New Testament writers tell us? Is our warfare is not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers. Our warfare is in the spiritual realm. It isn't that now God is giving us the right to go out and kill someone in the name of God. This is the problem of the Crusades. You know, you're either going to convert or die. That can't be our gospel message, right?
No. Sounds very not Jesus-y.
Right.
Well, I think even to turn it in, even because we talk in this space about like the violence, this like war, this like kind of all-encompassing space. I've heard a lot and I've seen this like, kind of, and this is a topic that even we got into a little in Theo too, about this like, well, God's a child killer. Mm-hmm. Like his ultimate act of violence was killing, having his own son killed.
Mm-hmm.
And how do I then reckon with a God whose response to have relationship with me was to be violent and to kill his own kid? And so I've seen obvious, like in comments of people and like on social media will comment and whatever to someone's video or whatever talking about Jesus and be like, but your God's a murderer, or like your God's a child killer, like that's cosmic child abuse, like that kind of conversation, which I know we've chatted a little in Theo too about that kind of belief of atonement.
But and that's so, very important, right?
Yes. It's the, how do we dig into that?
That is stems from certain versions of the penal substitutionary atonement.
Yeah.
So not all penal substitutionary theories are equal. They're not all the same, but that is definitely one. And then there's been a lot of feminist scholars that have reacted to that, and justifiably so, because you have like scholars or theologians like Wayne Grudem, John MacArthur, pastor in Van Nuys, has talked in these terms that the father is punishing the son on the cross.
Yeah.
He's unleashing his full wrath on the son and killing the son.
Right.
But if in fact Jesus is Yahweh, if in fact Yahweh is three, then God is hanging on the cross.
Right.
One of the problems of the penal substitutionary theory, at least in that kind of vein, is it separates the Trinity.
Yeah.
It's the Father attacking the Son.
Right.
But we're not seeing that.
They hypothesize the persons too much.
Right. And so it's God who is embracing his own judgment,
yeah.
God embracing the violence on behalf of humanity. So it isn't... So the corrective by feminist scholars is good, but it's not their solution is get rid of the cross.
Yeah,
right.
Right.
Can't do that. But it prompted a way what we need to rethink
atonement.
What we're thinking about with atonement.
Yeah. Yeah.
And even so, I think we can think in terms of the atonement and penal substitutionary ideas, but we need to identify those and clarify what we mean by penalty and substitution. Because
right.
clearly, if you look carefully at the text, God is not pouring out his wrath. God is not a God who needs to be satiated or his wrath needing to be satiated or him needing to be calmed down.
Yeah.
That's an ancient or Eastern and Greco-Roman concept that we've imported into the Bible.
Yeah.
Yes, he gets angry, but his anger isn't uncontrollable.
Right.
And again, it's God hanging on the cross.
Yeah, so. I was just talking to a former student about this who's an avid listener to TikTok Theology. Shout out Johan. Johan was he's texting me. And he was asking about penal substitutionary atonement. And one thing I said, and what I say very often is, the problem with these atonement theories taken as like the catch-all, like this is the one, is that we have to understand that they all are images of a deeper theological reality.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, I mean, we can definitely draw that. Like the sacrificial system is all throughout the Bible, and understanding what Jesus did on the cross through the sacrifice and through that system is totally legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's not illegitimate at all, but there's just more to it. There's just the reality of being reconciled because of what Jesus did for us.
Right.
That there's lots of different ways to talk about it. And so I often say, like, I think we just need to look at the atonement theories together as kind of like speaking towards a big and ineffable kind of reality of how we were made right and put back in the relationship with God.
Yeah, so Joel Green talks about his view is the kaleidoscopic view, taking all the images of the atonement together.
Yeah.
However, like you saying, there are aspects of the penal substitutionary theory that we need to set aside.
Right.
That's not there.
No. Yeah.
So when you pit the Father against the Son, and then the Son is persuading the Father, or now God's no longer an angry God because his anger's been appeased.
Yeah.
No, God sent his Son. Why? Because he loved humanity, not because he hated humanity so
much.
Right. I think, so we need to take
And not forgetting that he is God. This is God doing this for us.
Right.
Yeah. It's like, that's a huge, huge thing.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
I think that helps to then like, deconstruct in a way that God is not this violent, like, I'm gonna kill my own son because that's how I am. I'm violent and I need my own, you know, anger to be satiated because that's how I am.
Yeah.
So I think that helps even speak to the core of that.
Yeah. And again, anger is not part of his nature. What is he? Slow to anger.
Right.
He's even tempered.
Yeah.
You know, and when God says he's a passionate or a jealous God, he's really that word there is tricky, but it's more like he's a passionate God. He's intensely passionate about his people.
Yeah.
And because relationship has been violated, that's what sparks his anger is he got hurt, if you will. And think about the flood. Why did he bring the flood? Because of grief.
Yeah.
Not his anger.
Yeah. So, he was grieved that he'd ever made
humanity. So why the cross? It's birthed out of his love for humanity.
Yeah.
Not his hate and not unleashing his hatred on his son.
Yeah.
And this is hard, you know, God is one, but he's three. All three, in a sense, are hanging on the cross in the person of Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
So,
Jürgen Moltmann's The Crucified God is, I think, probably one of my favorite theology books ever. And he said, you know, when Jesus is on the cross, not only did the Son lose his life, but the Father lost his Son. And we can't remember that state of grief. Just imagine any of us who are parents losing a child. So like there's it's a multifaceted, complex issue.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I want to kind of hit before we stop, and this has been such a good discussion, because I hear this often, is a response to understanding God's violent commands of violence and stuff like that. Like Scott McKnight would say, God spoke to people in those days in those ways. And the concept there is God is speaking to people in a way that they would comprehend what it is, but they're not necessarily getting the fullness of what is being said. And an image of that is like, if you tell your child, a little child, if they're like, can I have this ice cream before bed? You're not going to say no, because see what happens is there's glucose and blah, blah, blah. Explain all that kind of stuff.
Right.
Like, which I can't even literally do right now. I tried. I just can't. But like, you're not going to explain all the little like kind of scientific details of why it's unhealthy for a human body or whatever. And they're growing, but you're going to just say something simple that they'll understand. No, mm-hmm. It's not good for you. It gives you too much energy mm-hmm. And it's not good for your body. You need to go to bed. You need to wind down. Mm-hmm. Right. So like, you're going to say something to them in a way that they would understand mm-hmm. at that time. And so like, talking about it in a visual sense, I imagine, okay, so you have things in shalom, perfect peace with nature, with God, with each other. And like, this is in the garden, we have shalom. And this is always God's kind of like ethical, you know, goal, his telos is to bring us back to shalom and to reconstitute that, to bring it back and to reconcile towards it. And so everything in it is to bring that back. Sabbath is to bring these rhythms of shalom back into our lives, all that kind of stuff. And so we have shalom, and then sin entered the world and we were ripped from it. Like, I mean, it's just completely, utterly gone. Like sin, the wages of sin is death, because we turn our back on God who is life. And so what do? You end up in death, right? So now people are in this place where they're warring, there's evil, there's hatred, all this stuff, this pre-flood kind of reality. And it's because they're so distant from God, because they turn their back and they're just totally there. And so when we see, for instance, if we have a number line or something, or I guess with letters, and there's A on one end and Z on the other. Shalom was A, you know, which is where they're supposed to be. But they moved off. Now they're in B, and they're just completely, you know, opposite from God. They're at B. Well, when you have like a law, like eye for an eye, it's moving justice from B right here to non-justice at all, to establishing some justice, see. And so like, if they were like super tribal back then, and they had kind of like this mafia logic, you know, like, hey, if you killed my sheep, I'll kill your entire family. Then, you know, God is saying, no, we're going to put limits of justice onto this. So if someone takes your sheep, you give them your sheep, eye for an eye, tooth for tooth. Mm-hmm. So he moved B to C, and there's incremental steps to where people could actually understand shalom again, the justice of God again, as we move forward. But it was always done in a way that they would understand in their very, very limited view of reality and this, in the society that's warring. Enter Jesus. Jesus drops us all the way to Q. Like, he brings us way over and says, you have heard it say eye for an eye, but I tell you to turn the other cheek. And he's getting towards a reality that's much, much bigger, where it's like that thing that was supposed to bring justice, you fossilized and made it into the law. And so now people are living by the letter of that law, and they're actually bringing unjust practices by that. Like that you have this desert to get back what has been taken, but actually you can be gracious, and that's what you should do. To, you know, turn the other cheek. And so he's not redefining justice. He's not saying that it was wrong. He's moving them along that line over to Z, and Z is kind of this eschaton, the telos, where we're in perfect shalom with everything, but moving us over there. Do you think that's an appropriate way to view how violence is understood in the Old Testament, that it's kind of spoken in a way that they would have understood, and that there is this incremental move towards justice, towards shalom, but that shalom will be, and I mean, we got a hammer dropped on us when Jesus came in and just changed everything, but it's still moving towards the return of Christ and you know, the reestablishment of the New Jerusalem and stuff like that. Do you think that's an appropriate way of kind of
considering? Yeah, I mean, I think you're kind of talking about progressive revelation.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and I think there's some merits to progressive revelation, but what oftentimes happens is then the end, if you will, or the culmination of that revelation, then now we don't need to think about anything else that happened before. Mm-hmm. I know you're not saying that, but that kind of the trip of that is that, oh, so everything else that came before towards that end, it no longer has theological merit.
Yeah.
And I think because God still is depicted primarily as a warrior God, there's something that's telling us about God even in those earlier texts. But that being said, when, like Joshua, for example, is being written, one of the questions, who's it written to?
Yeah.
It's got to be somebody way late. And so these descriptions of war are part of Israel's distant past, not something that they're practicing now.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so I think we need to think about that. But also I think progressive revelation has merit, but we don't want to then decanonize
right.
what's come before.
Happened. Yeah, it happened.
And that but also it has theological import.
It does, totally.
So it would be more of a both and than, I know you're not saying that.
No,
but
totally.
That,
I'm totally with you. There's an unfoldingness, but there's a lot of God even doing in the unfolding as it's coming. I mean, so like even we have, you know, the one of the most epic, I think, awesome images, subversive images in the whole Bible, in Revelation, when they heard a roaring lion and they turned and saw a slaughtered lamb. And that's literally the lyrics of Weep No More. This is the video you're in. I want to put that in there. But just a subversion of like this warrior God, this conquering king, how did he conquer?
Right.
He conquered by the cross, by taking it for us. And so,
And yet Revelation 19, he's coming as a warrior God too, to bring judgment on the nations.
Right.
Right.
But even so like N.T. Wright will argue, so you know how his robe is dipped in blood. Some people think that he was conquesting, but N.T. Wright argues that that's the blood of the martyrs that actually he's coming to bring justice towards. Fascinating.
But I think one thing that I wanted to highlight too is that the God of the Old Testament is obviously depicted and engaged in violence, but he doesn't have, and I'm separating just for analogy here, he doesn't have eternal damnation.
Yeah.
When you die in the Old Testament, that's it. It's over. Mm. Whereas Jesus now introduces something beyond that.
Yeah.
And so John Golden Gay said that it's almost far worse, if you will.
Oh yeah.
The judgment. So there's the Bible isn't, the New Testament is not exempt from violence.
No.
But what, we are not commanded to engage in violence. Mm. Jesus, as you're saying, Stephen, takes on the violence of the world,
right.
embraces that.
Mm. Yeah.
But Jesus still has enemies. We're called, Paul calls us enemies of Christ.
Yeah.
While we were yet enemies, Christ died for us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? And the New Testament is littered with quoting Psalm 110:1, that Jesus is sitting at the right hand of the Father until his enemies are made or become a footstool for his feet.
Right.
And those enemies are obviously demonic, but also human beings that resist and reject Christ.
Yeah. Mm.
And then there is then this, we're all going to face the judgment seat of Christ.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And give an account for our life. Jesus still is pointing to the end, like you're saying, but pointing also to the real potential of being separated forever from God.
For sure. But even that, like the, you know, Jesus also says to love our enemies. And then Paul will say, like, if you love them and repeat a kind word to them, it's like pouring burning coals on their heads. which I love. I love how petty that is. You know what I mean? Just like Paul's like, you're like, yeah, you're right.
Well, that would speak then to then it would probably be a different, like God was revealing himself in a different way to the Israelites of the Old Testament because they were a nation and they were a people group. And it was very different than Jesus coming and then bringing in a priesthood. Like we are all a priesthood a holy nation, like people who are following him. And so I feel like that kind of speaks to what God was revealing to Israelites when they were
right. And this is the problem
in their ancient Near Eastern, like very, very different space versus the people who were around when Jesus came.
Yeah.
And I feel like that speaks. And then what we've been since then speaks to that difference of, well, we're not all a very specific, like we're not all like the nation of Israel. And so it's a very different reality now.
Yeah. And that's what, right. So at the time of Jesus, there's all these messiahs around. Mm-hmm. And the one characteristic of all those messiahs is they're revolutionists.
Right.
And they do it through violence. Mm-hmm. And this is what Peter's expecting when he says, who do you say that I am? And he says, you're the Christ. You're right. Bingo. Right. Mm-hmm. But then he describes himself, I'm going to die.
Yeah. They expected violence.
Right.
Subversion.
They expected Jesus to come violently.
Because he's a king. What do kings do? They rule by war and violence. They conquer.
Not this king.
Right.
So it's almost like a perspective shift.
And then Peter says, no way, right? Get behind me, Satan.
Yeah.
So I
think an important theme is to say it's not that violence is absent in either testament. It's the point that you're making. It is all wrapped up in the idea that in this, God is establishing his justice, mm-hmm. his reconciliation, and ultimately establishing shalom. Mm-hmm. And so much of it is, I'm going to subvert your expectations, subvert this kind of like talk of war and stuff like that in your own language, and then show you, you know, the truth about it. This king doesn't do that. This king is born in a manger. This king, you know, comes back and then takes the wrath of people upon him in order to save them. And I think that's, you know, a beautiful gospel mm-hmm. message that reverberates in the kind of the realism that there is violence and war in this world.
Yeah, and that God, he uses Israel, but they fail
all the time
in their mission to be the people of God.
Yeah.
So he takes on human flesh. Jesus is Israel, mm-hmm. fulfills where Israel failed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He succeeds and then embraces violence rather than executing violence. But he provides free access to relationship to him.
Yeah.
But if you reject it, judgment.
Right. Yeah, that's still the wages of sin. It's still the wage of turning your back to God, who is life.
Right.
Is death. So
right.
That's really good.
So as we wrap up here at the end.
So good.
I could listen forever. But how should we understand God's character in a way that's faithful to scripture and is relevant for us today? So we like to end with these like pastoral, these ministerial moments where you can give something really practical. Because we talk a lot of theology, we talk a lot of things. But what advice could you give that's tangible to Christians today that's understanding these kinds of tough issues like violence and war and that kind of stuff?
Well, it seems like war is inevitable. War is ugly, gross, horrible, but it's like Golden Gate saying, you know, like a necessary evil, but not calling... God isn't calling us to be an army that is engaging as Christian warriors to mm-hmm. conquer people groups. We want to conquer them with the good news of the gospel.
Yeah.
But I think, too, that one way we could think about that in a pastoral way of, let's say, God's anger is that the writer to the Hebrews talks about how we know that we're children of God. And we have a heavenly father because he disciplines us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When he gets angry with Israel, as I said earlier, it's always with a redemptive purpose. Mm-hmm. It's always to bring Israel back. And the same thing in my own experience has been when God has gotten angry with me and I've actually experienced pain, real pain.
Yeah.
But it's God calling me back to him to repent.
Yeah.
And calling me back to relationship with him. When he's angry, it's because I've violated relationship with him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I've hurt him. He's grieved. And I need to be either embrace my discipline or be better yet, quick to repent ask God to forgive me. But I think, you know, the violence of God, the anger of God is revealing something very important, that God is a real being that feels.
Yeah.
And feels intensely.
Yeah.
He isn't a robot. He's not a magical formula. He's not a philosophy. He's a person.
That's mm-hmm. good.
With feelings. And we're engaged in a relationship that's dynamic, a give and take.
Yeah. Yeah.
And equally so, I can get angry with God, frustrated with God,
yeah.
and express those. I mean,
you can let him know.
Yeah. Read the Psalms,
yeah.
right? All over them.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and so we're free to express our frustration with God. And anger with God.
Yeah.
So it is really in the bottom line, we're in a relationship with mm-hmm. a living being.
Good. Yeah.
So
it's good.
Awesome. So good. You know, J-Dub, it's a pleasure to always chat with you. You are a mentor to all of us and have been to a lot of people through the years. And I think people can see why. You've got wisdom, clarity, but also biblical like you let the Bible say what the Bible says without like giving into what somebody wants it to say or how somebody feels about it. And I think that's a really, really important thing for all of us to take, you know, as we're going here. If you like what J-Dub said, that man can teach you.
At Life Pacific University. Which this podcast is sponsored by the School of Theology and Ministry at Life Pacific University.
Nice, the setup.
Plug.
She got it.
Plug.
Real quick, it's been an absolute joy to be with you two. So enjoyed this. I was actually a little panicked. But
not as crazy and stressed as it feels.
No. More panicked about the subject than you two. So
It's a tough subject, not easy answers, but I think you handled it perfectly.
Thank you.
Thank you, J-Dub, for being with us today.
Thank you.
We're so thankful for you.
See you all next time.
See ya.